Good morning, everyone. It is Monday, December 4th, 2017, and the Green Bay Packers have playoff hopes at least for another few days thanks to a 26-20 overtime win over the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, taking advantage of the overtime rule that says if you get the ball first and you score a touchdown, you win the game, and that's what they did. So here to break all of it down with me is fellow beat reporter Tom Silverstein. And Tom, what did you make of that drive in overtime that kept everything afloat for them?
Well, it was really a nicely constructed drive, and it was an example, I think, of McCarthy finally acknowledging what was working. There were some changes that needed to be made as the game wore on in their running game, and really they seemed to find some plays that worked. And a lot of it had to do with them using pulling guards and letting Williams run behind those. And so it was, the whole thing was set up by Jamal Williams, and everything that happened on that drive was due to either Williams actually carrying the ball or his impact on the game.
When you look at, you know, this game in general, given the fact that Aaron Jones did practice, the fact that, you know, he said he felt pretty good after the game, I think he even told reporters he was at 100%, were you surprised that it was essentially a 99.9% dose of Williams except for the final play that ended up winning it?
Not completely. I figured he'd play more than that, but I didn't think that they would play him a lot. I just figured that with that knee injury that he was sort of an emergency kind of guy, that if maybe they would rest, you know, if Williams was overworked and they needed him, they would put him in for a series. But I never really thought they would just play one play up until the final series, which was just really incredible, especially given how the game ended.
You know, for Williams to finish with 21 carries for 113, that's an average of 5.4, and then he chipped in with two more catches for 10 yards for another 5 yards of pop there. I mean, he's been over 20 to 25 touches now the last few weeks, and, you know, for a guy that it really looked like at the beginning of the season he wasn't ready, you know, at least to find ways to be explosive or to break tackles and things like that. Is it as impressive to you as it is to me to see the force with which he runs the ball now?
Yeah, I think, you know, and I'm reminded that when coming out of training camp, he was by far the best back they had. I mean, every day we were watch practice, and he was the most confident. He was used the most. He looked natural, and then he got into the games, and he didn't produce. And suddenly, Aaron Jones gets the shot, and he's the guy. I mean, he produces right away. And so Williams kind of got shuffled into the background, and I'm not sure. I shouldn't say I'm not sure. I definitely did not see him producing like he is now, being that durable, being that really secure with the ball. That part is really impresses me. He, as tough as he's running, I haven't seen him come close to fumbling yet. And then, you know, now they get to work in Jones, and, you know, if Aaron Rodgers ever comes back, they have a lot of options.
You know, it's funny you mentioned ball security, because that's one of the things that you and I and some of the other writers track during training camp is how often these guys put the ball on the ground. And I remember there was at least two or three weeks of camp where I feel like fumbles were a pretty big story when it came to these running backs, whether it was Jones putting the ball on the ground or Mays or Montgomery. And Williams was actually, if I remember correctly, the only one that didn't fumble in training camp. And now the fact that he's showing that security in as many touches as he has, I have to think that that's, you know, a big boost of confidence both for McCarthy and for running backs coach Ben Sermons, because now they know that, you know, they've got a guy in Jones that they've that has shown that they can ride him for 25 carries if they need to, and now they've got another guy to do it as well. Can you remember many years of or teams rather that you've covered where there's been a legitimate fight to see who is the true number one tailback for the Packers?
Not time. I mean, really, you think back, you know, Starks and Lacey, but Lacey was by far the number one. I mean, Starks sometimes performed a little better, but Lacey was the number one. Probably have to go all the way back to Edgar Bennett, Dorsey Levins in the mid-90s to really have, unless I'm forgetting some other backs, because like Amon Green was their number one for, you know, 6-7 years. I think I'd have to go back that far.
So as this game unfolded and you saw, you know, the way that Hundley was struggling on offense, but you saw the way that Williams was able to produce on the ground, and you saw the way that the defense actually played a pretty solid game for defensive coordinator Dom Capers, when it gets to overtime and the Packers win the toss, given all that you had seen, what did you expect at that point?
Well, you know, when they won the toss, I thought they're really lucky, because if Tampa Bay gets the ball, I think they go right down the field and score. You know, the defense had been on the field for 74 plays for the second week in a row. That's a lot of plays. And you could see they were pretty worn down. They weren't playing that well to begin with, but they were just worn down. And I think that was probably the luckiest thing that happened to the Packers that day, was that they won the toss. I was very curious to see how McCarthy was going to handle the drive, whether he's going to take the ball out of Hundley's hands and go to Williams. And essentially he did, other than, you know, letting Hundley run that read option, which was a key play, and the scramble too was a very important play. But all in all, it kind of went down the way I thought it would, which is that McCarthy would not put all the stress on Hundley.
So we've talked about Hundley and the best ways to use him essentially since the very first day that Rodgers got hurt. And one of the things that we've sort of weighed the pros and cons of is how much to allow him to use his legs or not use his legs. And obviously there was a hamstring injury that factored into that as well. But, you know, looking at the numbers today, he ran 7 times for 66 yards with a long of 18. And as you mentioned, there were 2 key plays on that winning drive in overtime in which he used his legs. Now, I wasn't at the game, obviously, as I'm still recovering from my knee surgery. So I was just curious, in talking to some of the players or listening to McCarthy, was there an indication of whether or not it was by design to allow Hundley to use his legs more, or did he just take off?
Definitely they wanted to run the read option. That was definitely a part of their plan. They were watching Tampa Bay crash down on Williams a lot throughout the game, and they just felt like that was open. And they finally called it in a really critical situation. Now, they did it on a 3rd down play. They were successful doing that as well. I think they wanted to really work Williams and then work off of Williams. And I think that's exactly what they did. And I think it was a really smart maneuver.
One of the things that I am sort of, and maybe this is me just extrapolating things out a little bit, you know, assuming, and we don't know for sure, but assuming that Rodgers does play again, is how does this offense potentially either morph or become reinvented when you have a guy that is capable of throwing the ball 40 times a game successfully versus, you know, an offense now that is not capable of doing that? In other words, are these running backs going to go from sort of the feature and the staple of what McCarthy has had to do since mid-October to all of a sudden, maybe if Rodgers does come back, they don't play as significant of a role anymore? Have you thought about that at all?
Yeah, actually, I was thinking about that today. Really, to me, what it does for them is one of the things that has confounded Rodgers at times is when teams go back into their 2-deep coverage and they play, you know, man under, and they just bottle up the wide receivers. And the Packers have never been able to counter with a really consistent run game. I think now they have that potential, and as long as McCarthy doesn't get really too enamored with Rodgers coming back, and try to blow everybody out of the stadium, I think you have some ability, and especially with Rodgers being able to change plays at the line of scrimmage, you have a chance to be a much more diverse offense, and you're able to really counter whatever it is the defense presents to you. And I think that's going to be really interesting to see, assuming Rodgers is coming back. They keep everything they're saying sure seems to point in that direction, but I, you know, we really haven't seen Rodgers, not since the early Eddie Lacy days, have a really consistent run game.
And that's sort of what I was driving at, because not only is it a consistent run game, but it's a consistent run game with two guys that can do very different things at times. You know, you look at Jones, and that's a guy that if Rodgers saw something where he thinks that there's a play to get outside the tackles and to make plays in space, you know, you can do that with Jones. And if he sees something where it's a light box and he wants to pound it up the middle with Williams, you can do that with a guy that you would expect to at least break through the first initial contact. And so I think it gives them not only two distinct, you know, options in terms of run or pass, I think it gives them options within running and passing that can be pretty unique. And again, I mean, this is something that I'm sure we'll discuss long into the off season, but it just makes you wonder, as time goes by, how and in what ways does Ty Montgomery even begin to have a role anymore?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't even really think much about him. I think the whole part of the key is that McCarthy can't forget the run game, and he has to remember that in order for a run game to be good, you got to use it. You know, you have to get your linemen kind of lathered up and willing to get in that aggressive mode where they're moving forward instead of always dropping back and pass blocking mode. And I really think, you know, it could change things a little bit in that Rodgers could be really, really efficient. Not that he isn't already, but you could see opportunities where, you know, maybe he only throws the ball 25 times and completes 19 passes or something like that. I mean, you have to let those guys touch the ball a little bit. So they'll have to really think about it when he comes back. And, you know, when he does come back, he's not going to be 100% right away. So let's just say he comes back against Carolina. And, I mean, we're talking about a really good defense. Why not start it out running the ball and take some pressure off him? Absolutely. And then let him work off of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the things I was curious about is I know that they have option one and option 1A in Jones and Williams, but does it surprise you at all that even still they haven't at least tried to boost Mays' confidence a little bit and give him something at some point in time so that he's not just kind of riding along in this perpetual doghouse?
Not unless they're in a blowout game. No, I would not even let him touch the ball unless it was not in a game that means anything. I mean, they just can't. You can't afford to do that. You know, especially now you got Jones. Apparently, you know, he looks like he is pretty close to 100%. And Witkowski's there. I just don't think you can take that chance when you're in a winner take all. You gotta win or go home.
So, you know, as much as we just focused on the run game, zooming out a little bit and looking at the offense as a whole, you know, I think that, again, when it comes to Hundley, you're sort of seeing that these glimpses, maybe like the fourth quarter against Chicago or the stronger performance in Pittsburgh, they tend to be deviations from the norm rather than the norm, I think. And you look at Hundley today, 13 to 22 for 84 yards with a passer rating of 48.3 and another interception. What did you think of what Hundley was able to do and not do today?
Well, I'll tell you one thing that's occurring to me is that he doesn't play very well at home. And I wonder if he just puts too much pressure on himself or gets too hyped up or just feels too much responsibility when he's playing at home, because he's looked better on the road than he has at home. And, you know, and the Pittsburgh situation, in a really hostile environment, he really looked calm and together. And today he couldn't complete a wide open pass. So I don't know if that's a factor. If for some reason he just, you know, he changes and gets a little nervous when he's at Lambeau Field. Maybe it's the best thing that they're going on the road next week. What I saw again from him, there were numerous times that, you know, he could have stayed in the pocket a little longer, but more than anything, he was inaccurate.
Yes.
He just was off. And, you know, how do you not hit Geronimo Allison on that corner route? He was so wide open. And the Nelson interception was really dumb. I mean, there's no way he should be breaking towards the middle when you got a safety hold, you know, standing back there. And then, you know, he missed on Adams a couple times. It was not a real good day for him.
Yeah, I mean, looking through the numbers here, his longest completion was 14 yards on a slant to Devontae Adams. And, you know, for all the talk that he's mentioned and other players, too, about wanting to take shots down the field, it just seems like any time he does take a shot down the field, the accuracy, as you mentioned, is not there to be counted on. And, you know, I hate to sort of harp on the same topics that we've discussed, but, I mean, if it wasn't for Devontae Adams, I honestly don't know who he would throw to on offense because, I mean, Cobb had no catches and Nelson had 5 for 17 yards. It's all Adams.
Well, Nelson, it's pretty clear, has really lost it. I mean, he just is not running very well at all. Now, he may be able to win some routes based on his route running when Rodgers comes back and the timing and everything. But right now, he can't run by anybody. And they have to start considering playing Allison, for instance. I mean, that was a great route that Allison ran. The Buccaneers took Adams out of the game. They just doubled him the whole game and said, okay, let Jordy Nelson beat us. And it was a good strategy. And moving, you know, as they go into these games now, they can't worry about Jordy Nelson's feelings. They got to win games. And it may mean playing Geronimo Allison a little bit more, or even Trevor Davis, who seems to be getting some confidence on those returns.
That was one thing I was going to mention is I don't know how much longer, and I don't know if maybe people like you and I, or maybe just me, make a bigger deal out of it than it seems, but I don't know how long the skill positions can keep going with absolutely no speed on the field. And so that's why I wonder, at some point, do you have to give Trevor Davis 5 to 7 snaps a game? And even if you're not throwing it to him, just the fact that he can do things to make people respect the speed where it might open something up for somebody else, I just feel like there has to be at least some threat of something down the field that isn't Devontae Adams on a double move. And so I'm surprised that they haven't sprinkled him in, even just here and there.
Yeah, I agree. You know, if they ever hit a deep one to him, it would be really advantageous because he would be that threat, you know, any time that he's on the field. I could see sprinkling him in. I just think that Allison is such a good route runner, and you don't have to have blazing speed to get open deep. You know, you need to be a good route runner. And that's what Nelson was so good at. He had good speed, but not great speed. And he was such a good route runner and was able to, and this is what I think Allison does well too, is run the routes all at the same speed. So they don't really, you know, the corner can't really tell that you're going deep because you're all of a sudden accelerating. You run everything at the same speed. I think they have to consider doing that. I'm surprised he didn't play more after that touchdown, or after that potential touchdown, because, you know, Hundley, you know, went for him, and after that it was Jordy Nelson for short yardage.
I agree, and especially on a day where Randall Cobb wasn't even targeted at all. It makes you just wonder why not change things up a little bit. And I know that this particular player had zero outcome at all on the game. But this is the first time we've done a podcast since they decided to promote Michael Clark to the 53-man roster. What do you make of that decision in the potential, you know, next 3-4 weeks here?
Well, I was looking for Michael Clark in the locker room after, but he left early. My guess is that they were going to lose him, that someone wanted to sign him. And I think that probably caused them to sign him to the 53, and they might have offered to pay him full salary and stay on practice squad, but maybe he just said, you know, no, I want to go play somewhere. So I want to check that with him, especially since he's his own agent.
Yeah.
He doesn't have an agent. Only he really knows what happened. But I'd be really curious. And my guess is that's what happened, because they didn't make him active. And, you know, he may be inactive the rest of the year. But they obviously like him a lot.
Flipping over to defense a little bit here, what did you think of the Packers' plan and how they wanted to sort of combat, you know, the two big targets for Tampa Bay in Mike Evans and DeSean Jackson today? Or yesterday, rather.
Yeah, well, I really, really want to ask Dom Capers about this, because so they matched up Devon House with Mike Evans, and they matched up Randall with DeSean Jackson. And it worked out good from the standpoint of shutting those two guys down. They each had, what, two catches apiece, I think?
I believe so, yep.
No touchdowns. But you look around and look at who beat them. You know, I think those screen passes are the result of them playing that that matchup defense, because you figure all they got to do is run Evans and Jackson, you know, out of the play, and they're taking the two corners, the wide guys, out who can come up and make that play on the screen. You know, if you're in a zone coverage a little bit, you're at least looking at the quarterback, and you can come up and make a play on that screen. But I wonder if that was the whole key to why they were able to be so successful on the screens. And, you know, also the middle of the field was just chewed up. The safeties can't stop anybody. And Jermaine Whitehead playing on the tight end was an absolute joke. And that would be Randall. So, I think they got what they wanted out of it, but I don't think they got exactly what they needed out of it.
So a couple things on what you just said. One of the elements that jumped out to me about the Bucs using the screen passes so effectively is that despite the fact that they were running what amounted to true wide receiver screens, they were able to get the ball in the hands of a running back in Charles Sims. And I think that what you saw with Sims was, you know, there's a lot of wide receivers that are really good after the catch, but he looked extremely fluid and natural on a lot of these screen plays. And I don't know how much teams would be interested in changing week to week moving forward, but the fact that a team was able to take advantage of the Packers' deficiency in covering screens, which has been there all season, and do it from the perimeter with a player who's used to having the ball in his hands and breaking through contact, to me that seemed like a pretty ingenious way of doing it. And I know that there was a big one called back due to penalty, but Sims had two catches for 35 yards, and I think it probably would have been closer to 3 for 50 if that third one hadn't been called back. And so that is an area to me that is very intriguing as the Packers move down the stretch here, is this thorn in the side that his screen passes continues to bother them. And then the Whitehead thing that you mentioned is puzzling to me too, because what they certainly could have done is they could have played Hawkins on the outside with House and then put Randall and Burnett in the two slot positions in the dime, as you mentioned, to put Randall on the tight end or Burnett, whichever one you want there. And so I was extremely surprised to see Whitehead in that position, not only just because of from the amount of playing time, but also the amount of trust that they put, knowing that Jameis Winston's favorite target, as admitted by his coach during the week, is Cameron Brate.
Mm-hmm. I just think you have a cornerback, a guy who plays slot in Lindsey Pipkins. Why do you have him on the roster then? Play him.
Good question.
You know, I mean, you can't tell me that Jermaine Whitehead is that much better than Lindsey Pipkins. Now, maybe he's more assignment sound. That could be you know, and if that's the case, then maybe it's the right decision. But I just don't like the idea of having two safeties playing in the slot. And essentially that's what you're doing in the dime with Whitehead and Burnett. And your safeties aren't playing very good to begin with. So I just, you know, I mean, you got corners on the roster for a reason. They're corners for a reason. Why wouldn't you play them?
Very good question. Very good question. It's hard to sort of evaluate a lot of times the play at the line of scrimmage without going back and watching the game. But did you get a sense at all, or even from talking to some of the players in the locker room, about what they thought Kenny Clark was able to give them or not give them so quickly after that high ankle sprain?
Well, man, he had two sacks. And, you know, once again, he got crumpled at the line of scrimmage, and I thought he was done. I thought there's no way he's coming back in the game. And he comes back and he gets a sack. And then, you know, I mean, he had made, I think on like one of the first plays he comes back, he makes a great tackle on a running play. He's just invaluable for them. Now, I know they did run for a lot of yards. And, you know, I think they were able to scheme the Packers a little bit. I'd like to watch more of it and see exactly what they were doing, because I couldn't really track it very well watching the game. But, you know, they have to have him in the game. He's just, you know, he's really good at penetrating and, you know, maybe needs to be on the field a little bit more on third downs too.
Well, that to me was a little bit of a surprise today. I always thought that Kenny Clark has the potential to be a nice pass rusher given his athleticism and his explosiveness and things like that, but it almost seemed like the jump that he made from the last couple weeks pre-injury, the contribution he was making in the pass rush to what he did today was exponential. At least it seemed that way to me. Now, I know that Tampa Bay put two starters on its O-line on injured reserve earlier in the week, and that certainly matters. But
their backup center was going to was ill, so he didn't play. So they had to play Dietrich Smith at center, and he played terrible.
Absolutely. The biggest difference to me between Clark and Dial is just the quickness in the lateral movement. And I just think what he's able to do, shedding guys and making plays, whether it's in the backfield or just a yard or two downfield, I agree with you. I think that at this point in time, you could put him in the top two or three most important defensive players the Packers have.
Yeah, and he makes Mike Daniels so much better. It's very hard to double team Daniels when Clark starts making plays like that. So they need to have all those guys in the lineup. And you know, I will say, I said it in my column this morning or Sunday morning, don't make too much of all the sacks. They're facing a team with a devastated offensive line, and next week they're facing a team that has the third most sacks allowed in the NFL. Until they play someone who's any good or has a decent offensive line, don't judge their pass rush, because I'm not really taking much out of this game at all on that front.
Absolutely, and I think that, you know, the biggest test that they have left on the schedule will probably be that penultimate game on December 23rd, because the Vikings do have a very solid offensive line that has managed to stay healthy. And until then, you know, I'm not totally familiar with Carolina's line, but I know that Newton has taken some punishment at times this season, so I imagine the Vikings would be the best test that they have left. Now, again, we didn't do a podcast leading into the game, because I wasn't there late in the week. But, you know, the Kevin King situation is one that I just kind of wanted to revisit a little bit. Sure. I know that I sort of floated the idea to you of sort of saying, you know, and this is just me talking, I didn't have any inside information, but I just kind of wondered if one day we're going to wake up and all of a sudden Kevin King's going to be put on IR. What is the thought about his shoulder right now from what you heard during the week leading up to Sunday?
You know, so nobody is really saying that anything close to that he needs IR or needs to go on IR. I think what they're trying to do is manage it right now and manage it in case they need him down the road. I mean, they could have used him today in the worst way, because they had to play Jermaine Whitehead in the slot. And, you know, Kevin King probably would have matched up with, well, they probably would have gone side to side and then put Randall in the slot. But without King, they're a little bit different defense. And I think they're going to do everything they can to get him functional. And he's not going to be healthy the entire year. And it's obvious that he can't do, they don't think he's going to do a lot of damage. I think it's a matter of pain and you know, being flexibility and range of motion and that kind of stuff. So maybe they sit him until he feels really good, and, you know, or maybe they just see, okay, if they win at Cleveland, then maybe, you know, maybe they don't play him against Cleveland and see where he's at, and then maybe they have him for down the stretch. I don't know. I mean, because they're not real honest about injuries, but I don't think they need to put him on IR right now. I think they can play it out as long as they don't think that he's done.
Other than Kenny Clark going out of the game and then ultimately coming back and Demarius Randall being evaluated for a concussion but clearing the protocol, was there anything else that came out of the game that is potentially concerning for the Packers on the injury front?
House injured his shoulder and sort of intimated that it was more serious than, you know, thought. You know, he heard it on that deep ball to Evans, and he said he continued to play because he just felt he had to finish the game. But he sort of made it sound like it was not real good. So that's something to watch this week. I'm trying to think if there was anybody else. Randall cleared the concussion protocol. Clark came back. I think that was pretty much it. I think everybody got through otherwise, you know, unscathed.
In terms of, you know, one of the unsung heroes from the game that jumped out to me, and I'm curious to see what you thought as well. I thought Justin Vogel had a heck of a day today, especially at a game when field position was crucial.
He did, and once again, their gunners had really good days. Janice was really solid, and Trevor Davis is turning into a pretty good gunner as well. That combination helps them flip the field pretty well. This is not like, you know, previous years where they can't get out of their own end zone. You know, they're able to at least clear some room for themselves. And so, I think Vogel's been solid all year. I think what we're going to be really watching for, and it'll probably be this week against Cleveland, is really cold weather.
Absolutely. And, you know, his best kick was 57 yards, and that was in one of those positions where he basically had about 6 inches between his foot and the back of the end zone, and he clears it to the point where it gets beyond midfield. And I know that, you know, maybe the difference between kicking it just beyond midfield and kicking it to the 45 is maybe only 8 or 10 or 12 yards difference. But, you know, I remember talking to Vogel about it during training camp when he had a kick similar to that in an exhibition game, and he sort of explained that there's a big, at least in his opinion, a big mental advantage for the defense when you can get it even just a little bit beyond midfield, because it makes them think that, you know, they can give up one first down without necessarily being in field goal range immediately, and they have at least a little bit of wiggle room. And that was the sense that I got today. When he was able to kick those punts just beyond midfield, it almost felt as if he was giving the defense a little bit of life without necessarily sending them onto the field as if their backs were pressed against the wall immediately.
Yeah, I'm looking up that punt because I thought that there might have even been a penalty on there, and it pushed it way back. I may be thinking of a...
Oh, no, you're right. You're right. There was a holding penalty. I see that. Yeah, he kicked it. He kicked the ball from his own end zone to the Tampa Bay 40-yard line, and then there was a 10-yard holding penalty that backed it up.
Yeah, but that's still a pretty good punt to the 39-yard line.
Yeah, no question.
From the 4 to the 39. I mean, and then you get the holding call. That's exactly what you want. And so they wound up flipping field position of 67 yards.
And how about the special teams in general? I mean, not just, you know, Vogel, but obviously there was the blocked punt by Fackrell. There was a couple of nice returns by Trevor Davis, you know, one of which was wiped out by a holding penalty on Vince Beagle.
Ridiculously dumb penalty. Wow.
And so what do you make of the special teams unit that seems to have enough guys that can make some really nice plays, but boy, do they make some silly mistakes.
Yeah, I don't know what to make of that. They have to cut down, or they have to take guys off who are making dumb penalties. And you can see they have done that with Josh Jones. He's not a gunner anymore, and Trevor Davis has taken that over. They just can't afford to keep making those mistakes, because that wiped out a huge game, and Humley needs all the help he can get. And they had a chance, you know, actually had a pretty good day with Trevor Davis. So, yeah, that's something to keep an eye on. I am really surprised that they were able to get close to a punt again. Not exactly the same place where they came, but it made me wonder if Zook worked off of what they did last week and then sort of made it look like it was going to be that again and did something else, because Fackrell came through pretty unscathed.
Yeah, almost untouched, it looked like.
Yeah, and you know, they got some guys with some interesting body types between Allison and Fackrell, some really long dudes who can get close to those punts. But, you know, they got to be consistent about it, and I'm still not really convinced about them. But you know, the one thing they do have is a kicker, and they have a punter and punt return unit, or punt coverage unit. Those are two pretty big things.
And zooming out a little bit, looking at the NFC playoff picture today, Sunday rather, was actually a pretty good day for the Packers. You know, the Falcons lost to the Vikings, which obviously does the Packers a favor because that's a team they're fighting for potential wild card spots. And the Lions go down, and Matt Stafford exits the game with a hand injury, although x-rays on the hand were negative. What was sort of the mood in the locker room after the game on Sunday? Was anybody sort of starting to at least intimate that maybe they can get this thing rolling sort of along the run the table lines that Rodgers put together last year?
Yeah, you know, I think most of them felt pretty lucky that they escaped this game. And they tried to make it seem like, you know, this was an inspiring victory, and they, you know, did what they had to do. But they know they didn't play very well. And so I didn't get the sense that nobody was crowing about, you know, okay, one down, five to go. I think they were like, okay, Cleveland's next, and we'll see how that goes. I don't see a team that's just rolling right now. I do know that, you know, they're propped up by the fact that Rodgers might be coming back, and I think that's part of why they keep practicing him in front of them, is to sort of inspire them. But the part that is going to be interesting this week is whether they really tighten up against Cleveland. You know, whether they just figure, you know, they got to win this game, and so all of a sudden they get really anxious and nervous and don't just go out and try to beat the crap out of them, because that's what they need to do.
No, that's a really good point, because if they're viewing the potential return as Rodgers as the mountain they need to reach in order to be relevant in the playoff push, then obviously this is the must-win game. And looking at the Browns' schedule here, I mean, yeah, obviously they haven't won a game, but they've played some teams pretty tough. I mean, they lost to the Chargers 19-10 on Sunday, and the Chargers are one of the hottest teams in the league. 2 weeks before that, they lost 19-7 to the Jaguars. They've been in close games with the Vikings. They've been in close games with the Jets and the Steelers. They only lost by 3 in the season opener. So for a team that hasn't won a lot, it doesn't seem as if effort is a problem for them. So I agree, that is going to be a fascinating game to see whether or not, you know, nerves and anxiousness creep into the picture. Is there anything else from the Bucs game that you want to touch on before we sign off for this podcast?
No, I don't think so. I think we covered a good deal of it.
Well, that will be a lot of coverage for you guys to check out. I know that despite the fact that they were down a man, everybody stepped up and did the whole next man up NFL concept for
That's
me
right.
over the weekend.
That's right. Yeah.
So how was the live blog?
It was not bad, not bad. People were, you know, there were a lot of fire capers in there, and there was a lot of fire hundly, but I think people were pretty shocked by the ending, and but I don't think anybody was fooled by it. I don't think anybody came out of that saying, "Ooh, this team really has got it together." That they, you know, they're on this run now. I don't think you could leave this game feeling that way.
So be sure to check out all of the coverage from the game on JS Online and PackersNews.com. We thank you all very much for listening to this podcast. There'll be all kinds of coverage coming up throughout the week as it looks like Aaron Rodgers will continue to practice. So be sure to read all of that and check out everything we have throughout the upcoming days. So as always, we thank you very much for listening, and we will talk to you guys soon.